Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Brian Mackey, who's out this week. Managing family life can often feel like a juggling act, especially for families with young children. But perhaps we might apply some valuable insights and tools from economics and the business world to better manage our home lives. In September, the 21st welcomed onto the show Emily Oster, a professor of economics at Brown University. Oster has also carved out a niche writing books meant to help people apply rational thinking to family life. Her previous books are Expecting Better, about pregnancy, and Crib Sheet, about the early childhood years. Now she's out with The Family Firm, a data-driven guide to better decision-making in the early school years. We wanted to replay that conversation for you today. Listeners, please note that because we're re-airing this segment, the phone lines will not be open, but do feel free to let us know what you think by tweeting us at 21st Show or emailing the 21st team at talk@21stshow.org. Here's Brian Mackey's conversation with economist Emily Oster.
Emily Oster, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. Pleased to be here.
And on a personal note, this is a conversation I've been looking forward to in some ways since July 2019. You were on the Slate Money podcast. It came up that you and your husband use the business-oriented software Asana to help manage your household. And I'm very excited that you now have an entire book sort of on some of these topics.
It's true. A lot has changed since then, that's for sure.
Sure. So before we get into some of the specifics, the big idea in your book is that families should think of themselves like a business in some ways, at least. Can you make that argument in brief now?
Yeah. So I think that the central thing I want think families should pull out of businesses is the idea of being deliberate about the choices that we make. I think even those of us who spend a lot of time at our jobs sort of thinking carefully about what we want to prioritize and the decisions that we make sometimes don't take that kind of deliberate thinking over to our households. And so most of the tools in the book are around the idea of, hey, think about what you want your day to look like. Think about what's most important to you. Try to make the decisions that you make, the day-to-day decisions, line up with these central priorities. And that's kind of the way to make your family operate more happily.
Was it a Lennon song that said, you know, life is what happens to you while you're making other plans?
No, it's right. It's like people say, well, you really want me to write down what I should do on a Tuesday? Well, that's 1/7 of your life. So yeah, I think you should think about your Tuesdays.
Well, all right. So on that note, you urge people to start with a big picture, which is, I guess, kind of like a mission statement for a family, but really more than that. So why is that important?
So the big picture is, yes, it's the idea of a mission statement, but it's also the idea of getting very practical and actually saying, you know, here are the really big pieces of my life that I want to prioritize or of our family life. And I urge people to sort of sit down with their partner and try to work this out together, but actually try to write it down separately and then kind of come together and talk about it. Because I think that, you know, part of what we sometimes do, particularly as our kids get older and things get busier and there's more of a dominance of logistics, is we don't always take those steps back and say, you know, now that there's more choices about the things we could do, which of those things do we actually want to do? And what are the pieces of the day that are most important to each of us, to everyone in the family? And how can we kind of craft our day so our decisions will reflect those realities that we've said are important?
Right. And one of the examples, I mean, simple example, but if it's really important to your family to have dinner together every night, no matter what, then you're probably not going to want to sign the kid up for the evening soccer league or something like that.
Let's
talk about some of the process you suggest for this. You have sort of a step-by-step, starting with values and priorities. What should people be thinking about there?
So I think there, you know, you want to think about a relatively small number of kind of key both things that you really want to make sure you do every day. So family dinner or, you know, every week. So family dinner would be an example of that. Church would be an example of that, sort of things that you think, you know, if we're going to do three really important things or they're going to be three really important parts of our lives, these are them. And so that's kind of the first, that's kind of the first step, just grounding us in, you know, what do we actually think is really important?
And then after you sort of have that sort of values and priorities out there, you sit down and actually make a schedule, right? How detailed should people be with this?
Yeah. So I think in the book, there's like a literally a schedule worksheet. And I kind of suggest to people, you know, think about a sort of typical weekday or a typical weekend, and, you know, what do you want to have in, you know, in every hour? And I mean, not exactly like literally what's, you know, like, what do you want to be doing at 11 o'clock on, you know, Tuesday, October 8th or whatever, but in general, you know, in your typical weekday, do you want to be sitting down for dinner together? Do you want to be sitting for breakfast together? What time are you envisioning people going to bed? You know, are parents going to be home in the afternoon? Is someone else going to be home in the afternoon? And then when you think about weekends, you know, do you want your weekends to involve a lot of extracurriculars, or do you want them to involve a lot of concentrated family time? And so the worksheet, the sort of schedule idea, is to sort of take some of those big priorities and then get down to brass tacks and say, listen, you know, if we want to be achieving some of these priorities, if we set our priority as family dinner, well, then when we sit down with that worksheet, that means that, you know, 6 o'clock or 6:30, we're all going to be doing that in that hour block. And that means other things aren't going in that hour block. And I think that's that kind of recognition, that kind of being concrete, is a way to try to better align what you're doing with what you think you should be doing.
Yeah. And you take the schedule, then you take your values and you turn these into, I guess, more general principles, right? And that's where you can sort of set up some maybe time saving. You know, some things, you, like we were saying, if you have a standing dinner at 6, then you don't even really have to think that hard about conflicts with that necessarily, right?
Yeah. And I think the other piece that this potentially helps with is, you know, it is with sort of within family kinds of conflicts. Some of this is about making it possible for everyone in the family to kind of quickly make some kinds of decisions based on the fact that we have agreed about what's important. So you know, I can, when I answer a question for one of my kids about, you know, can I do the following activity, or, you know, can I eat this kind of thing? Like, you know, we have a set of priorities or a set of schedule things we've agreed on. It's easy for either me or my partner or even our babysitter to kind of make all of those decisions because we have sort of agreed on these principles in advance.
And the last thing, while we're on this idea of creating the big picture for the family, is responsibilities. Why in your view is it important to sort of have these things delineated, as opposed to, you know, catch as catch can, and whoever's available does a given task on a given day, for example?
So I think that the issue with responsibilities is that everyone always thinks that they're doing everything, and in your there's always more things to do. And so I think it's very easy to get into a situation where we all feel that we are doing more than half. You know, you can have 6 people in the family, they all think they're doing 70%, and it, you know, and I think so some of the idea with the responsibilities is to say, look, if we write down what actually has to happen, it makes it much more vivid. Like, what are the things we're splitting, and how are we splitting them? And is it in a way that's reflecting, you know, different people's capacities, different people's time, and so on? And the other piece of responsibility articulation for me is sort of figuring out what can we ask of our kids, and what kinds of responsibilities can we pass on to them? Because I think that, you know, as kids age, they are able to take on more family responsibilities, you know, and if we aren't thoughtful about which ones we give to them, I think we can wind up in a situation where, you know, our kids are 16 and all of a sudden we decide they should have a huge amount of responsibility because now they're kind of adults, but actually we haven't prepared them for that. And I think that's where we run into some problems. So there's a sort of alignment and kind of development of your kids' keys, both of which go along there.
What is your view, sort of a sidebar on this topic of child responsibility, but allowance and responsibility and whether those things should be tied? Where do you come down on that?
It's interesting. You know, we don't, I will tell you, sort of, I think families will differ on this, and there's probably a lot of good ways to do this. We actually don't do that. We don't do allowances in my house. The kids have responsibilities, but we haven't tied them to money. We've tied them to, like, this is just the way that we behave in the household. But I think that there's, you know, I'm not sure that there's, I know in fact that there is not particular data on whether there's a right way to do that or a wrong way. I think it's like a lot of these things, it's, you need to think about, you know, what is your kind of, what is the message? What is the sort of central way that your family thinks about this? And in our family, it's, we don't tend to think about it like, you know, people get kind of paid for keeping their room clean. But other, you know, I think that that is a perfectly reasonable way to do it, just in the way we do it.
Yeah. I think the New York Times money columnist Ron Lieber has said that, you know, at some point the kids won't need the money. He argues for a similar approach. He separates giving the kids like sort of an allowance or spending money separate from chores, because at some point the kids will be old enough that they won't need your money, and then they won't want to do the chores.
It's a fair point. Yes.
Yeah. All right. We're speaking with Emily Oster. She's an economist at Brown University. Her new book is The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early School Years. Oster also has a newsletter and has devoted a significant part of that to helping people think through their personal level of COVID risks. We're going to talk about that a little later as well. So after a family gets their big picture sorted out, you also talk about a decision-making framework, and this comes up throughout the book, but let's just sort of lay out what you mean. You start with the four F's, and that begins with framing the question. Can you talk about why that's important?
Yeah, so in your family life, you will be faced with a lot of decisions, the big decisions, things like where should my kid go to school, and you're not faced with them every day, but you know they come up a couple times a year, and I think part of what's hard about those is they're almost so daunting that it's hard to know where to start. And so the four F's is really a system, one of many, but I think, for me, a sort of useful structured decision-making system for these kind of decisions. And it starts with the idea of framing the question. And that is really encouraging people to say, what are the actual choices that I have? So, you know, we sometimes will ask, should my kid go to this school or not? Or not's not a school I'm familiar with. You know, you actually, like, there's a moment where you need to sit down and say, what are the actual two or three real alternatives that I'm thinking about, not just, the one alternative and some nebulous other option, but rather that, are there two viable options here or three viable options, and exactly what are they? And to frame the question in that kind of concrete way.
And you have this example in the book. I mean, when you're thinking of like the parent of a baby or a younger child, if the kid has some, an unusual looking diaper, we'll say, it's easy. You call the doctor, maybe you clean up if you have to. You can sort of get a yes or no. Is something wrong? Yes or no. These are questions where, because of the sort of, you can't explore the counterfactual of like, what if we send them to the private school versus the public school? There's really no right answer in some ways, right? Or you'll never know. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I think, part of what makes these decisions hard is that we're sort of expecting in most of our decisions to like know immediately if we're right. And here, you're never going to know if you're immediately right. In fact, you'll probably never know if you were right at all. And so it is hard then to have confidence in being right. And so I sort of tell people, having a structured way, feeling that you have made the decision in a thoughtful manner, that's about what you can get to, is to sort of feel like I've made this decision well. Not that I've made the right decision, but I made the decision in the right way, because you would never know if you made the right decision. But that kind of, confidence that you at least did it in a thoughtful manner, I think is worth a lot in feeling confident about the choices that we make.
Yeah. So framing the question, so important. See, once you have framed sort of a concrete question that's not, should my kid go to school or not, but what are the three school options, for example, that where my kid could go? You say fact finding is the next step. And I'm going to sort of wrap this into the next step, the third step, which is the final decision, because I'm the type of person, I could, as a journalist, I have deadlines, but if I didn't, I could spend my entire life just on the fact finding part without ever actually turning it into a story. So can you talk about, fact finding, and then how when you've found enough facts to actually make a decision?
Yeah, I think it's great that you lump these two together, because I tend to lump them together as well, because I think part of what is problematic about our decision making is the kind of continual fact-finding decision making, like, I don't know, hamster wheel or something, where we get one piece of data, one piece of information, and then that kind of pushes us in one direction. And we're like, okay, I'm going to make that decision. Then you get another piece of information, you think, oh, maybe I should make this other decision. And so some of this is about saying you should get all the information at once and try very hard while you're getting the information not to be constantly re-upping your decision, and then set yourself a deadline to say, okay, this is the point at which we're going to have the information, sit down and make the decision. And I will say, we talk about fact-finding here in a lot of choices that you're going to make. So think about something like what school is your kid going to go to. there is some data, and that data could be things on, you know, what are the test scores in the school look like, or, you know, it could be general data about, you know, how, what do we know about the kinds of schools that kids do better or worse at. But there's also a piece of this fact finding, which is other information. You know, if we send our kid to this school and our other kid goes to another school, you know, who's going to drive them? Like, literally, how are they going to get there? What is the day going to look like? This kind of gets back to some of the stuff at the beginning, like, you know, can we make the logistics of this work and what will they look like? And so you really kind of get all that information together. And the idea is to decide up front, you know, what are the pieces of information that I need? I'm going to get the information, and then we're going to sit down with that information and make a final decision, and try to have it be the case that after that deadline, we make the decision, we implement the decision, whatever way it is, that we then move on, and we don't try to constantly, you know, the next day wake up and kind of second guess the decision.
Yeah. Just even coming to that final decision is something. I mean, I'm thinking back, there's so many open loops in my family life right now of things where we've sort of framed a question and found facts, but we've never really come to that final decision. All right, we need to take a break here. We're going to continue our conversation with Emily Oster after a short break. She's the author of The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early School Years, and more to come with Emily Oster after a short break. Stay with us. Listening to The 21st, I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Emily Oster. She's an economist at Brown University, or I should say a professor of economics at Brown University, and the author of The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early School Years. And earlier I mentioned that I first became intrigued with some of these ideas 2 years ago, listening to Emily on a different podcast, and she had just sort of mentioned, it kind of came up in passing, that she and her partner use Asana, which is a business task management software. People at Illinois Public Media use it for staying on top of the website programming and planning. But she uses that in her home life. And so, Emily, I want to ask you, before we get into the specifics, you write in the book that you have a generally high level of confidence in business process organization. I mean, I generally share that view. My undergrad degree was in business administration. But, you know, when I think about my spouse, who I should say is a smart and accomplished doctor, I think if I were to try to get her using Asana or Trello, I would end up using it to plan my new life as a single man. So what do you say to people who do not share that sort of confidence or enthusiasm for bringing a work app into the home setting?
Well, first of all, I think you should try, because I don't think you know yet that she wouldn't like it. But you know, I think that there are families who are going to come to sort of different places on whether they like this idea. Let me say sort of one general thing and then one more specific thing. So I think in general, part of why I think people are very resistant to this sort of idea is it feels very clinical and cold, and it feels like, you know, well, we're a family, like, you know, we just love each other. Like, why would we need this? You know, like, we're just going to make it work because we love each other. And I think there's a little bit of a push in the book to say, like, hey, we can love each other, but like, still want to like manage our family efficiently, and to recognize that, you know, once you have kids, particularly kids in this sort of like high logistics school age period, there is no avoiding that some of what you're doing appears to be some kinds of logistics manager activity. and that you can make that work better, and that that will leave more time for, you know, things that you like to do together, like, I don't know, talking to each other, not about who's going to drive who where, if you've already done that elsewhere. I also think there's a lot of different ways to bring some kinds of organizational technology into your house that are not just that are not like task management. So there are, you know, we use a lot of Google Docs in my house. And even for things as simple as like, there's a checklist before the kids leave for school in the morning so they don't forget their lunch cards and other stuff. And we just like have this Google Doc checklist and we like switch it up every, there's one for the winter, there's one for the summer, and we just like switch it up. And that's a sort of very simple kind of thing where some kinds of sort of a little bit of technology in the house is helpful rather than just yelling about how you forgot your lunch card again.
No, and I should say I'm with you. We have a shared calendar app.
See, or, there you go. Yeah, already, you're already there.
Right? Yeah, yeah, no, yeah.
We Asana. I don't know, you know.
It's the learning curve, I think, that would be, I mean, I'm intimidated by Asana, for goodness sakes. I do use Todoist. That's a different one. So what are some of the tools that you do recommend, though? You mentioned Google Docs, shared calendars.
So I think shared calendars are can be really helpful, especially if you check them. Google Docs for us have been really useful, and just very generally useful for keeping track of checklists, for keeping track of sort of like priorities, and if there are, you know, family, if we have rules about various things with the kids, it's like a simple sort of place that we can have that shared. And we do use Asana for sort of bigger, we have used it especially for sort of bigger projects, like we were renovating our house. It was much easier to sort of keep track of things there. I will say the other thing for us is there's some of this is just like how do you interact about the logistics, putting aside the kind of like what are the tools. So it's things like when we talk about something, it's very common for my spouse to send me like an email afterwards to say that says something like, you know, following up on our discussion, we've agreed on the following like four bullet points about what's going to happen next. Like, let me know if I've missed anything, which I think if people were reading that, they're just like, oh my gosh, like you have like the weirdest marriage. Like, but the thing is like, yeah, that may be true, but actually we also really like each other. So, you know, it's not all bullet point lists.
Yeah, no, I get that. And you memorializing the conversation the way a boss would. Yeah, I think that,
exactly.
You know, you got to have both partners on board, I think, to make something like that work.
Yes, otherwise, you need to be married to another economist. That's like the key, too. That's the key.
Well, all right, people, listeners, keep that in mind. Try and find an economist if these ideas sound appealing for you. So, all right, so what we've talked about so far, right, the big picture, the four F's of the sort of decision-making process, some of the tools, that's really just the first part of the book. And then you have a lot of the sort of data for which you're best known, of, you know, helping people think through pregnancies and the early childhood years in your previous books. Maybe we can just pick a couple of examples here that you go through in terms of like applying some of these ideas to some of those big picture questions people think of. One of the ones that jumped out to me was this idea. You get a call from one of the third graders in your son's class. She says her son's feeling bad for being left out of soccer at, you know, school recess or whatever. And then she says your son is the ringleader doing the excluding. How do you approach that?
So, you know, I sort of talked through in the book, like probably as a parent, your first instinct when faced with this kind of thing is to be either very angry with your kid or very angry with the other parent or both. So it's, you know, very hard to kind of hear that. But, you know, I talked through the idea of like stepping back and actually trying to use this kind of 4F, some version of this 4F approach on this, which is to ask, you know, well, what are you actually trying to decide? Are you trying to decide if you're going to punish the kid, if you're going to talk to the school, if you're going to interact with the other parent, that you then also want to really like think about finding out what happened. I think a lot of our parenting is in that kind of moment can be very reactive as opposed to, you know, actually trying to learn the details of what happened. And then I talk about, you know, okay, let's say it turns out your kid is bullying or your kid is being bullied or there's something else going on, that actually, you know, there is a fair amount of research on, you know, how we can improve interactions among kids at school, interactions for our kids, how we can think about developing empathy in kids. So it's a place where, you know, there are some things to do. And part of the value of kind of reacting in a more deliberate way is that you leave space for seeing what some of those things are, as opposed to just sort of yelling at either your kid or at the other parent.
Yeah. Let me just take a moment to reintroduce you. We are speaking with Emily Oster, who is the author of The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early School Years. And one of the other things I want to ask you about your book is you have a chapter sort of helping people think through what sort of parent they want to be, right? Helicopter, chicken, tiger, or ostrich. We have had Lenore Skenazy, who is the one of the free-range parenting gurus. I guess that's the chicken
sure.
one.
I know Lenore,
we've had her.
She's the chicken parent. I love her.
Yeah, yeah, we've had her on the show a couple of times. It's one of those things that I sort of appreciate more in principle and sort of get cold feet about every time I start to think about actually doing it. But can you just talk through sort of an overview of that, how people might, think about what sort of parenting style to adopt?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that there really in this chapter, I kind of try to dial into the question of how much independence are you sort of interested in giving your kid? And that independence really has two pieces. I think Lenore talks a lot about the sort of physical independence of, you know, like letting your kids kind of like roam a bit more free. And I think that's, you know, that's a big piece of sort of thinking about how much of that do you want to do? There's also a responsibility independence piece of this that I think is probably more closely related to the question of sort of how helicoptery are you? So if you think about something like, you know, like your fifth grader, they have some homework. How much is it their responsibility to make sure that their homework is done and put back in their backpack? And I think families take pretty widely divergent positions on, you know, is it my job to stand over you and make sure you're doing it and then make sure it's in your backpack and send you off to school with it? Or is it my job to like tell you that's your job and help you figure out how to do it and then to just like not help you? Or am I just going to like let it, like let you be responsible for it? And you know, there is kind of some evidence that that there's probably a happy medium, that, you know, not being involved at all as a parent has some risks, and more involved parents, you know, kids tend to sort of do better in various ways, but also that you can probably over scaffold. And there's a lot of, you know, discussion even among people who kind of deal with college students that, you know, kids sort of show up at college like kind of never having like made their own breakfast, and they have a hard time adapting to being responsible people. So I think that there's a tension there where even putting aside the physical freedom, there's the responsibility freedom. But it's also hard because if you tell your kid they're responsible for putting their stuff in their backpack, some of the time they'll forget it. And that's actually a very hard thing to kind of like let happen as a parent.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, we've only got about 5 minutes left in our conversation. And I want to turn now to a topic you've covered a lot in your newsletter, Parent Data, which does have a lot of the same sort of things we've been talking about. But, you know, the four Fs, the decision-making process, that can be used beyond parenting in thinking about life. And you've written a lot about thinking about COVID risk. And you had a recent piece with the headline, COVID, when will it be, quote unquote, over? And I've been wondering about that myself. So what's the answer? When is COVID going to be over?
So there are kind of two answers in there. So one is, you know, in some ways never. So I think that, you know, the pandemic will end, but COVID is going to be endemic for our whole lives. So, you know, I think it's hard sometimes for people to hear, but like we're not moving to a place where there's no COVID. It's just not realistic. It's not the way that coronaviruses work. That doesn't mean people are going to be getting sick in the way they are. That doesn't mean, you know, that we're not going to have vaccines, but you know, it does mean that kind of waiting for something to happen where people have announced, okay, coronavirus is gone. It's 2018 again, you know, no COVID, like that's not realistic. But at the same time, you know, for people who are fully vaccinated, the risk of serious illness remains, you know, is very low. And for kids, even unvaccinated kids, the risks are very low. So I have a little bit of a pitch in the newsletter about, you know, there kind of will be a point at which you will need to decide to stop making this the most salient risk, the only thing you're thinking about. And that's, I mean, it's going to be hard. This is going to be a hard next phase, particularly for those of us for whom this has been such a salient risk all the time for the last, 18 months to kind of move it into kind of the flu bucket. That's going to be a hard transition, but it's one we're going to have to eventually make.
Yeah. And I think some people, I mean, you have faced you've been caricatured by some as, being in different spots on the spectrum. I will say I've been somebody, I've appreciated your newsletter. I've read some of the critiques as well. I wonder if you can just talk about your place as an economist in thinking through these issues, as opposed to, virologist or immunologist or a physician. I'm sure you're aware there's a sort of strong strain of criticism, like, who is she to be weighing in on these things?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's like two sort of, I will say one general thing, which is I think the idea of credentialism is not very helpful in the face of an unexpected pandemic, that in general, we probably need views from a lot of different people who bring a lot of different things to the table in order to make good decisions about this or kind of about anything else. I think what economics brings to the table is the idea of sort of trading off risks and benefits. So I spent a lot of the last year talking about schools and actually collecting a lot of data on schools and trying to sort of work to understand the risks of COVID in schools. But part of that was motivated by the recognition that, there's kind of potentially risks of opening schools, and we need to know how large those are. I think it turns out they're pretty small. But, any risks that we do see there, we need to weigh against the benefits of in-person schooling and the benefits on the other side for kids of learning, of mental health and parents' employment, all this other stuff. And that there's in almost all of these choices, there's going to be some risk-benefit trade-off. And I think that's the kind of thing economists spend a lot of time talking about, which is sort of more of our purview. So, but I'm always doing stuff that's a little different than the regular.
All right. Well, if people want to check out more of Emily Oster's sort of day-to-day analysis of COVID-19 and plenty of other topics relating to parenting, check out that newsletter. It's Parent Data. It's free. Her book is The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early School Years. Emily Oster, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that is all the time we have for our program today. Before we go, I do want to make a pitch for joining our texting group. You can send the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, text the word TALK, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730 to sign up. We will send no more than one message a day, and it's not seven messages a week. But, asking questions of our listeners, it does help inform our coverage and shape our program. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Erica Scalise is our engagement producer, and our interns are Owen Henderson, Zainab Qureshi, and Brio Skullark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.